Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for the day, Greta Anderson. In today's show, we check in with Kelly Diekman, the City of Ames Planning and Housing Director, to discuss the new developments going up in Ames. And we ask Planning and Zoning Board member and Urban Planning Professor Carlton Basmagian whether our town really has a plan for where development should take place. We also speak with a teacher and administrator at the Chinese Language Academy in Ames about an event they are holding for children this Sunday at the library. But first, let's take a look at statewide governance on issues surrounding hog confinements in Iowa. I'm here with Jess Mazur of Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement. Jess, you are the lead organizer for issues surrounding water. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm a farm and environment organizer at Iowa CCI.
And apart from the whole Bakken pipeline, which is a huge undertaking for your organization and many other activists around Iowa, there has been a lot of stuff going on in your department with hog confinements and hog processing plants. And so I really wanted to catch up with you to get the latest news on what's been going on in central Iowa in particular regarding hog confinements. Let's start with the processing plant that was denied in Mason City. The city council ultimately voted against the processing plant. Prestige Farms out of North Carolina then put their bid into Eagle Grove. What's happening with that?
Well, in Eagle Grove or in Wright County, there was a lot of community members that also did not want the facility, but it was just kind of a different makeup in that county. The Board of Supervisors seems like they haven't seen a factory farm that they don't like. The industry is just a lot more intertwined into that community. So the supervisors did approve it, but not without, you know, a good fight from the community members there and people who are going to live around the facility. So that project is moving forward, but it is a big victory to show that, you know, when people do organize, when they get together and build power and not afraid to step outside of their comfort zone a little bit, that we, you know, we can beat big money, we can beat corporate ag.
And then there are three new CAFO permit applications for Webster County. Is that correct?
Yeah, I've actually heard it was six.
Oh.
Yeah, actually, I'm looking at the farm news right now. It says six hog confinement applications target southwest Webster County. I think that kind of just shows that, you know, one of the talking points that we were talking about with members up in Mason City and in Wright County is that if this slaughterhouse builds, that we will see an influx of factory farms in this area. And we heard from Prestige and supervisors and the Mason City City Council and other industry people that that was not true, that we would not see an influx of factory farms. And
that we would not see an influx, because they had it all covered. They all of their, at least the first shift, they said they had covered already with the farms already in the Prestige system.
Exactly, yeah. So it just kind of proves that that industry is willing to say and do whatever it takes to get what they want.
Webster County is in relation to Wright County?
It is just a little bit southwest, kind of at the corner, southwest corner of Wright County. It's just west of Hamilton County.
Oh, okay. All right. So Hamilton, we got that whole tier, Hardin, Hamilton. They're already huge hog-producing counties. And then we've got Webster coming in just to the west of it, adding all these new CAFOs.
Exactly.
Now, I heard there was a CAFO application up in Cerro Gordo County, where Mason City is, that the supervisors actually turned down. It's a pretty rare thing for supervisors to look at a master matrix plan and say, nope, doesn't pass.
Yeah.
And then what happened?
Well, the county did deny it. However, they did not take points off of the master matrix. And we're starting to see that happen just, you know, a little bit more frequently this year, that counties are kind of starting to open their eyes like this is out of control, but they're not taking points off the master matrix. And so they're denying it for other reasons. Specifically in Cerro Gordo County, it was because it was near a private wetland that extends from a public wetland, and because of community outrage, that the community didn't want it. And so they denied it for those reasons, which the DNR doesn't even consider. So when the DNR received the county's recommendation to deny it, they overturned that decision and approved it. And then the county came back and decided to appeal that decision with the Environmental Protection Commission. And then just this Tuesday, the EPC voted to go ahead and move forward with the factory farm building up there, even though there were a lot of people that took the two-hour drive down to Des Moines to testify and say, you know, we really don't want this. Like, say no, we already, you know, we have a lot of resources in Sierra Gorda County that we want to protect, and we didn't want a slaughterhouse, and we don't want this factory farm.
A factory farm on a private wetland.
Well, it'd be near a private wetland.
Uh-huh.
But because it's not a public wetland, it doesn't qualify for the same separation distances as a public wetland.
I see. So the so this move by Cerro Gordo County was kind of a protest gesture against the whole process that was set up, I don't know how long ago, back at the beginning of Vilsack's administration, I believe.
Yeah. You know, they did the right thing and denied it, but we really need to push our county supervisors to actually take points off the matrix, because that's the only thing that the DNR will consider. And it really is simple to take points off the matrix. You just kind of look through their application. If they're not giving a good enough reason for what they're doing and why they're doing it, then we can take points off, because they're required to do the design, operation, and maintenance plans for each of the points on the master matrix. So, we need to kind of push our supervisors to take points off. They have more power than they've been led to believe they have.
Mm. And then the EPC, this is a governor-appointed body. Is it kind of comparable to the IUB, the Iowa Utilities Board, that we've been hearing so much about in relation to the Bakken Pipeline?
Yeah, yep, it's 9 members that are appointed by the governor, and their job is to oversee the doings of the DNR, the Department of Natural Resources. And just kind of like the IUB, it's stacked with industry insiders. At one point in time, 5 of the 9 commissioners owned or had interest in the factory farm industry. So it's definitely a board that is meant to do exactly what corporate ag wants it to do.
And yet it is called the Environmental Protection Commission. I remember a few years back when there was actually an environmentalist on the board, and she was taken to court for having special interests or something.
Yeah, they were trying to file a conflict of interest against her.
Because she actually wanted to protect the environment.
Yeah, it's ironic, right? She was actually doing what the name of the commission is. But, they don't really want people like that that are standing up for the environment and for our communities.
And so you were down, or lots of folks went down to Des Moines on Tuesday to be present at the Environmental Protection Commission meeting. Was there something else going on that day concerning CAFOs and CAFO rules besides this issue of Cerro Gordo County's single CAFO that they were rejecting?
Yeah, this is actually, it was a big deal meeting for us. We had over 45 people come and testify, because every 5 years, the DNR reviews its rules for factory farms. So whenever the legislature passes a new law, the DNR has to write rules of how to implement that. And every 5 years, they kind of open that up to kind of look at what's working, what do they need to strengthen, what do they need to weaken. And they put forth a proposal that would have weakened the rules for factory farms. And CCI members across the state kind of put together a list of things that we would like them to do to strengthen the rules and to provide more protections for our environment and for neighbors of factory farms. And we submitted, about 1,300 comments. And all in total, the DNR received 1,600 comments, which 90% of them said to strengthen the rules. And then on Tuesday this week, EPC heard testimonies, reviewed public comment, and voted to weaken the rules. They did not vote in favor of any of the public considerations, even though that they could have. Like, for example, one of the things that's been weakened is setback distances for public use areas. They changed the definition of a public use area, whereas it used to include the lake itself and the beach and the dock and the shelters or any other structures that surround the lake. They actually removed the lake itself and just included the structures and facilities around the lake. And, you know, there could be large stretches of shoreline around a lake that don't have any structures that are now no longer protected from setback distances of a factory farm.
Wow, that's really counterintuitive. I mean, I thought the whole point was to protect waters.
Exactly, right? That's what you would think, especially when I was in the midst of a water crisis right now with a record number of polluted waterways, and it's growing every year.
But it shows that they're really just concerned about bad PR, and it's bad PR if mm-hmm. people are near something that smells kind of bad, then they start to notice that we have a CAFO problem.
Right. Yeah, they're worried about that, and they're worried about what the industry wants. They are, you know, one of the testimonies that was given on Tuesday, I thought was a really good example of what the DNR has become, and it was agency capture, the fact that this government agency is no longer working for the people. The industry controls this agency. Because they, you know, the industry was able to weigh in and actually write some of these rules before the public even knew that this process was going to be taking place. So it's you know, not a good situation for Iowans.
And where does our legislature, those who are directly accountable to the voter, where do they come into this picture? Can they veto these new rules that are put out by the EPC?
I'm not sure if they can veto them, but they can pass strong rules and regulations that, you know, hold polluters accountable and that change practices so that we were protecting our water. We've seen over the past few years, like, we always introduce some good bills that strengthen manure application laws and increase separation distances and fight for local control and a moratorium. But what we see happen is that those bills die in committee. They don't even make it out of the committee, whereas bills that lessen manure application training or that allow factory farmers to store manure in abandoned factory farms, those, you know, we have to fight hard to stop them because they move quickly through committees. So it's, you know, almost like the DNR, we're seeing a legislature that is also unwilling to protect Iowans and the environment, and they're really working for the industry.
So we have an election coming up just a couple weeks now. What is your hope that will come out of that from your position as someone devoted to protecting Iowa's water?
Yeah, well, I hope that legislators are hearing from Iowans across the state that this is an issue that matters to them. I know that we've been working on a campaign for a moratorium along with a coalition of other groups, where that's kind of one of our goals for a moratorium, is that we need to educate the public more and get them involved in these campaigns to actually hold candidates accountable and hold elected officials accountable to govern as they campaign to vote, and, you know, eventually start running some of our own people for office to where we can, you know, if they're not going to work for us, we'll, you know, we don't want a seat at the table. We want to run the table.
Right. There's all kinds of local elections as well around the state. I mean, besides the Iowa House and the Iowa Senate, there's all these supervisor races, and there could be people out there running on an anti-CAFO agenda.
Yeah, and I think that's what we want to do. We want to make this a front and center campaign issue up and down the ticket, and, you know, start with running some of our members for some lower level offices like city council and supervisors, and work our way up to the state house.
And the moratorium is all about just saying no to CAFOs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if the DNR and the legislature are unwilling to pass any meaningful regulations, and if they're unwilling to make polluters pay for this mess that they've created, then, yeah, we're saying it's time we just stop. It's no more until Iowa has less than 100 polluted waterways, which would take drastic changes in Iowa law in order to do that.
Is this something there could be a public referendum on, statewide referendum?
I don't think we've really explored that route. I think our how we think we're going to do this is by building a lot more power in the state with everyday people from corner to corner of the state.
Great. Well, you do a great job of organizing, always have, with Citizens for Community Improvement. Jess, you're about to take off on a trip. Tell us about that.
Yeah, about 15 of us are heading up to North Dakota to go to the Standing Rock Camp and join with our allies up there to help stop the pipeline.
And will you be taking some supplies with you?
Yeah, we're going to be taking a family farm hog as a donation, and we're going to be bringing some firewood and some food and baked goods. And we're also, we've been making connections with a tribe out of South Dakota, and we've offered to help them winterize the camp. So they're going to let them put us to work up there.
Oh, fabulous. Sounds like a great time. I hope you have decent weather. Well, thanks so much for talking with me today, Jess Mazur.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Again, that was Jess Mazur of Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement. And it looks like that crew did have great weather this weekend. I read reports that more than 80 people were arrested up at Standing Rock and were maced on Saturday. And so perhaps we'll hear from some of them about those events on Local Talk. You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host, Greta Anderson. And we go from state issues to truly local issues of governance in the next segment with two guests who have just joined me in the studio. Kelly Diekman, Director of Ames Housing and Planning, and Carlton Basmajian, who is an Associate Professor and Director of Graduate Education in the Department of Community and Regional Planning at ISU. More to our purposes, he's on the city's Planning and Zoning Commission. And this is a mayor-appointed all-volunteer board. So we are going to talk about the new developments going up around Ames and also about the process of how those get approved or proposed and approved. So let's start there with the process. Kelly, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Kelly Diekman. It all begins when a developer comes to your department. Is that correct?
Typically, if we have zoning in place, which means it allows what types of uses, the density of how you can build, then you come to our department and you can come in with what we call a site plan to review how something's configured. It's a little bit different if we don't have a zoning on a site and somebody has an idea for how they'd like to develop. Then they're coming to ask for permission and ask for permits that go through the Planning and Zoning Commission and then through the City Council to get zoning and approval of their projects.
Okay, so if they don't have zoning, does that mean it's outside the City of Ames?
Not necessarily. In our city, we don't really have, if you're talking about vacant land that's just ready to build, we're pretty much filled up. We don't have a lot of vacant land just in the city. So if somebody has an idea about redevelopment, the zoning probably doesn't match their idea. So it could be right in the middle of the city. We just went through this for a project just next to Campus Town called the 2700 block of Lincoln Way. We had an old gas station, Arcadia Coffee, and a couple of old apartment buildings. It was a mix of zoning districts, but it didn't match what the developer wanted to do. So that was an infill site where they sought rezoning to Campus Town zoning.
Okay. And so the easy way is if the zoning matches what they want to do.
Correct.
And we have a plan that has all the zoning mapped out, but this is being frequently modified. It's called the land use.
The land use policy plan is the city's comprehensive plan, and what everybody seems to focus on the most is what's called the future land use map, and that's to direct developers of where we would like to see growth and how we'd like to see growth done throughout the city and also for expansion of the city.
Okay, so the developer knows that if their plans are in accord with the future land growth, future growth
or land use map,
future land use map, then they're going to have an easier time of getting approval.
In most cases, yeah. So only if we don't really have infrastructure to serve it would we probably not be looking at the timing component of that. So you might have a great idea that fits the plan, but if we have an extended infrastructure to serve a site, then we're not going to be looking to approve developments in advance of that infrastructure either.
Okay, right, because that requires outlay of cash and that requires council approval.
Correct.
Okay. Well, let's bring you in, Carlton Basmajian. Thanks for coming.
Sure. Hello.
And you're part of the Planning and Zoning Commission. What does that do?
So the Planning and Zoning Commission, or the PNZ, as we often refer to it, is basically a citizen advisory board. So we review these proposed projects that Kelly was talking about after the staff has done so. And we kind of talk it out. We listen to public comments, and then we vote and make a recommendation that then goes to the City Council for final approval. So we're kind of an in-between, in some sense, between the staff, the citizens, and the council in this bigger process.
Do you ever say, I don't like this?
Yes.
We don't like this?
All the time.
All the time?
All the time.
And what is the outcome when you do that?
Well, it varies. Sometimes what we recommend is sort of written up and approved by the council. Sometimes it's some variation. Sometimes it's not. It's kind of a mixed bag in my experience. So, you know, I would say that overall it's a check on the process in some sense. And so I think that the voices are heard for certain. But, you know, how that plays out in the final political process is up to the council. So it's strictly an advisory role that commission has in city government.
And what are some of the reasons you would say no to, or, you know, would you advise against a particular proposal? What drawbacks do you often see?
And from my perspective, I often see things that are what I consider a little bit ahead of the process. So proposals that maybe don't really fit within the speed of development that should happen, that I think should happen in the city. So there's a kind of a timing issue with a lot of developments, and that's oftentimes the complaint that people have is when things are proposed, not that they are necessarily bad developments on their face, but that is it the right time to be developing this particular thing at this particular location?
Okay. And that has to do with the growth of our perimeter and so on, right?
Right.
Well, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about how a lot of the latest proposals seem to be coming from the perimeter. It seems like last year was a big year for infill, especially around Campus Town. There seemed to be a lot of, you know, the last couple of years, a lot of stuff proposed to redevelop Campus Town, to take the old middle school and make that into a more dense development. And now it seems like the focus has turned away from students and onto families on the periphery. Is my impression correct, Kelly?
Well, I think we've seen a reinvigorated market for beyond student housing. So in my eyes, we're still seeing a lot of both, or I should say still seeing. We're now seeing a lot of both. The student housing demand is not going away. When we did a vacancy survey in the city last year, an occupancy survey last year, we were over 99% occupied in the sample of large apartment complex we did in the city. That's not a healthy market from a rent pricing perspective. We want to see more vacancies so there's more choice and more price moderation. So we know that there's a need for both the student housing component. And we finally have gotten developers to understand that we have a workforce housing need, people that just aren't students. And that's coming out more in the format of the structures now. We're seeing people that are willing to commit to doing smaller apartment complexes that aren't four-bedroom suites or five-bedroom apartments that have no place for a family, really, the way they're designed and what they cost. So we're now seeing both. So we still have the student housing because of the price point. They're still trying to seek that Campus Town location, still trying to be as close to campus as possible, but it all doesn't fit. So now we're into areas that we have seen growth. In some cases, we've seen growth planned. Others, it's more opportunistic where they're asking for land use plan amendments to try to meet that demand by adding supply.
Right. I like that word, opportunistic. So a developer might go ahead and purchase this vacant farmland or, you know, farmland that's for sale and then, you know, come to you and say, here's my idea for, multifamily homes or single family development or whatever. And it's hard to say no to somebody who has, you know, just outlaid all that money to buy farmland.
It really shouldn't be part of the decision-making process, and most developers don't actually outright own it because they know the risk that they don't have a right to that development. Some do. Some really roll the dice early on and take a position to own land and really think that they're going to have that approved, because we really don't – staff doesn't really worry about ownership of property, and I know the commission isn't really concerned about ownership of property, so that's it's a very risky thing to do of a developer to go buy it and say, I should be approved because I own this land already.
So what do they do? How do they bid for the land at the same time that they're trying to figure out the development?
So they write into a contract to purchase that they have a certain amount of time to go through due diligence. And if they're able to negotiate an extended amount of time for that, then they'll be able to do the approval process in that. Now, they have to make payments through the process typically. So they do get more and more invested the longer they're in a process. But when they first start out, they don't just jump in and buy the property. That's not normally how somebody would do it.
I see. But, Carlton, some of the timing issues that you were talking about would still apply for somebody who has the opportunity to buy this piece of land now and, you know, they want to get that thing going before their contract runs out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because, obviously, when land comes on the market or becomes available, it doesn't always stay available. So people make decisions based on the information they have, and timing is important.
Right. And this whole idea of expanding the boundaries outward through farmland and conversion is something new to you, Kelly, I know, because you came from California, Silicon Valley, where every community stretches in right into the next one.
Right. We already got rid of all the farmland 30 years ago in Silicon Valley. So, yeah, it's a little different, except for that the city did and has a good idea of where it wants to grow for a lot of different reasons. So it's not just what we would call leapfrog development. That would not be the way Ames does it, where just because a section of land might be available by a farmer, that we're willing to see it developed. We're pretty good in the city of Ames of following the ethic that we want to do sequential development and just keep building from what we've already done rather than jump ahead just because that's what's available today.
Okay. Well, let's talk about some of the developments that are being proposed right now. I noted some in the north, some in the south, and some in the west, the very periphery.
But east, too, if you want to talk about industrial development.
Okay. So the one that's getting a lot of attention is the Rose Prairie development. Mm-hmm. This is near Ada Hayden off of Grant Avenue.
Now Hyde, but yes, formerly Grant.
Okay.
We've renamed it Hyde, so it matches up now with the city street that was to the south. So,
okay.
So just to give the quick overview, so that area along Hyde, formerly Grant, is referred to as North Growth for the city. It's not just Rose Prairie. There's a Friedrich development called Quarry Estates, and then Hunziker also controls two different properties up there for development as well. But Rose Prairie is the largest, and it was the first that actually kind of made North Growth start off in the first place. So it was just recently rezoned, so they have a lot of process in front of them still to talk about subdivision and to review their stormwater plans and to look at about a lot of information about how the development actually happens. But they were just approved for 600 housing units, which were a mix of single-family and single-family attached and some small apartment complexes as well, with a commercial component as well.
A commercial component.
Potentially a small commercial component at the corner of Hyde and 190th Street. Okay. They really tried to come in and say, well, we think there's enough critical mass here that we can justify this. Definitely won't be the first thing we see out there, so it'll be many years before that happens.
Right. So that was rezoned as medium density.
It's mostly what we call FSRL, low density residential, but there is a medium density component.
Okay, that would probably be the apartment buildings?
The apartment component.
Okay. What is your response to that, Carlton? What did you think?
Well, I was opposed to this as a member of the Planning and Zoning Commission. My response to it was that it was too much on the fringe. And so, Kelly knows the history of this better than I do, but there was a prior development agreement that had a much lower unit count that had been made between, correct me if I'm wrong, the council and the developer.
Correct? Prior developer, not the current developer.
The prior developer.
The current developer bought this out of bankruptcy.
Yeah. So that thing didn't happen, and now the new developer came along. And so this went through several iterations. The first iteration was more units, was turned down. They came back with fewer units, which was approved. And my take on this was that this was a classic case of a parcel at the corner, basically will be the northwest corner of the city, that is not really connected to – it's connected to road infrastructure but not really connected to SIRIDE or other kinds of non-motorized infrastructure, at least not yet. And it's a lot of units. It's a huge amount of units on the fringe in the Ada Hayden watershed, which of course is the city's backup water supply. So there's all kinds of issues associated with this, and I felt like – at the moment, it was too much. It was too much when it was. Perhaps 10 years from now, 15 years from now, and if the city continues to build out in that direction, fine. But my take at hearing it here was, no, this is not a good plan for the moment. This is not a good development at that location at this time.
Uh-huh.
Rose Prairie is a great example of why you have a board in the process, not just staff and council. With Rose Prairie, there's a lot of policy issues, just as Carlton started to bring up, why we recommended that an apartment component be put in that project. We have a tool that we call the RH checklist, which is really a condensed version of our whole land use plan that tries to identify attributes that are either positive or negative about siting density projects. It was scored relatively low, fairly low actually, on that whole system, but we still recommended approval because we looked at it a little bit differently, that in the North Growth, if you're going to have 1,000 housing units over the next 10 years, you need a multifamily component for diversity. But if you just focus on the apartment itself, you'd say, well, we're never going to have transit there. There's no services there. why would we do that? So we had a little different take on that one, and that's why the board has another chance to look at that and say, well, what's the right density? What's the right mix? How does our policies of our plan go together? So that, I think Rose Prairie really articulates a lot of our ethics about what we're trying to apply policies for growth to, and you can reach different conclusions, and we definitely did in that process over time.
Uh-huh. The addition of the apartment complex gave them points because it gave them, well, we're always looking for more affordable housing.
So I think in this case, staff didn't say they had to have apartments. We would have been fine with doing the single-family home options that were previously approved, but we were okay with also adding that component that, to add some kind of mix.
Oh, okay. The developer wanted that.
They proposed it, and we tried to discuss what might be acceptable and how to limit that and where to site that most appropriately.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of nice to think about workforce participants, you know, low-end workforce, being able to go out their back door and go to walk around Ada Hayden. Mm-hmm. You know, up until now, it's only the very rich who have been able to do that.
And the other part is that you're in the Gilbert School District once you're north of Bloomington Road, so you're about a mile and a half from the school district. So, again, having that choice, when you think about how people live, it just because you're a family doesn't mean you live in a single-family for-sale house anymore. So for us, that's why we were thinking about the multifamily component. If you have a family and you want to go to the Gilbert School District but you don't want to own, you have very few choices about being a rental household and be able to go to the Gilbert School District. So that's another component of our evaluation and why the diversity was a good thing to add over time out there.
Okay. Well, then we have a development on South Duff, south of Mucky Duck.
Yeah. So then here's two that are completely different. You have I'll throw other one in there called University Boulevard called Village Park, which is right next to the Research Park. So both the Village Park and the South Duff project take a completely different angle. They said, you're putting so much investment in the Research Park. You have no housing in South Ames to support this. So this is that opportunistic approach. Our land use plan never contemplated the South Duff project happening. The Village Park area wasn't meant for as much density as was proposed, so that had to go through an amendment process to get that there. But they were both focused on, we're going to serve the employment base on the south side of Ames. And what we looked at most significantly there is what was the infrastructure that's able to serve it. So South Duff has highway improvements that are needed. There's major drainage improvements that are going to go along with that project. And we also got commitments to do smaller apartment units, 1- and 2-bedroom apartments, so they didn't turn into student complexes, which we didn't believe would have been palatable to the city on the edges of the city. So that's what we did through the zoning process on those two.
Okay. And your take on those, Carlton?
The South Duff project, I was adamantly against as well.
Okay.
I'm the no vote on everything.
That's why we have you.
Yeah, I felt like that was – it just didn't make sense as a location for a high-density apartment complex because South Duff is already a mess traffic-wise, right? It has very low side-ride service. It's a hugely congested place. It does have drainage issues, as Kelly says, which I know this is going to help at least partially alleviate. But it's also directly adjacent to the airport. And I know it's a multifamily building or set of buildings, so they'll be soundproofed. It's not going to be within the FAA problem zone of noise pollution. But it feels like sort of an island of relatively high-density apartments. I know there's some nearby as well. This is not the only group of buildings out there. But I felt like this is not, to me at least, this is not a good spot for it. South Duff is overtaxed. We should be encouraging this kind of density somewhere else. And the argument that the developers made, which is related to the Research Park, which a lot of people are making that argument now, is the Research Park. You hear it a lot. Didn't line up with the vision of the kinds of jobs, to me at least, the kinds of jobs that the university is talking about creating at the Research Park. And so my suspicion is this is really was another way to create some apartment buildings that are probably going to get occupied by students at some point, which is not a problem, but again, not a good location, especially for trip generation issues, like how many trips a day people are going to be taken out of these things. A left-hand turn onto Duff. And I can't remember. Is there going to be a traffic signal put in?
Yeah, so a new traffic signal
that'll
will be
help.
Installed at Crystal as part of this
that
project.
That will certainly help.
Right, this is on the west side of the street.
Yeah.
So they would have to turn left to get to be going north on Duff.
It's a left turn. north to Duff to 30, and then you run right into the U.S. 30 intersection, which is, you know, and
also congested.
Yeah, and Airport Road, which is it's a bit thick.
I see your point. So this is it's traffic is a big issue. Well, are there traffic people? Are there SIRE people on the commission, planning and zoning?
Not
commission?
Currently.
Oh, okay.
Now, I know that I think the staff, y'all consult with
SIRE. Yeah, so when the city staff is looking at a project, it's not just the planning department. We're always reviewing things with the public works department, with the city engineer, as well as our traffic engineer. Same with the water department, the electric department, and sewer and water as well. So mm-hmm. it's not just us coming out and saying it. It's internally vetted to look at that.
But the Village Park one, you thought that was okay?
Better. It's at least it's close to the Research Park. It's close to University. It has a little bit better access to the – I mean, if the audience, the clientele is ultimately University-related.
It's off of Oakwood, right?
It's a little further south. It'll be an extension of Cottonwood that doesn't exist today.
Okay.
Just south of Wessex Apartments, if that sticks out for people.
But it's close to to University Boulevard, mm-hmm. or the extension of University Boulevard. It's really close to the Research Park. It's much more accessible to campus than that side of town, if that's, in fact, where the people that occupy these buildings are going to end up working. So it felt a little bit more considered in mm-hmm. that sense than the one on South Duff. And that part of, at least from a traffic perspective, that part of the city is a little less stressed. You don't have as many competing uses, like commercial uses, for instance, along the highway commercial along Duff. You don't have that along South University that creates quite so much congestion.
So, and then for the Birch Meadows subdivision, which is Western Ontario beyond where there's anything yet, mm-hmm. I'm going to guess that you're going to talk about the congestion on Ontario Street as well.
Not as much.
Oh, really?
I was not opposed to this particular proposal. So that development on Western Ontario out there is – I mean, that cat is out of the bag in a sense. I mean, that's – it's pretty well developed. Those is houses in terms of affordability are a little bit more affordable than the stuff that's being built in the Northwest, which is a positive for people in the market to purchase.
You know, that's one that was pretty much as cut and dried as we've seen probably in the last few years. The plan said build single-family homes. Here I got a plan that builds single-family homes. I'm extending everything exactly how it is next to me. It was pretty much cut and dried. The interesting mm-hmm. comment is we had some neighbors come out, at least one or two, come out and say, why can't we have some commercial? We're just nothing out here for us. And that's true. Once you get to the edge of the city, the commercial doesn't show up for forever in this case, because it'll likely be at a node down by Lincoln Way rather than on Ontario. So that was an interesting comment to hear.
I had forgotten about that.
Why can't we have – you can almost say more of a village element added to it rather than just more single-family homes. But this project wasn't big enough to really – to do anything like that.
Yeah. That's what I was imagining, was how far these people would have to drive to get to anything.
Yeah. West Hy-Vee would be your closest services or North Fairway, if you think of it in terms of kind of splitting yourself on Ontario, which direction you prefer to go.
So we've talked about the developments, you know, on the individual basis, the pros and cons, but we haven't talked about all of them, I know. Mm-hmm. There's Country Club.
Well, the Country Club is technically outside of the city.
Okay.
So if you've been out towards Ames Golf and Country Club lately, you'll see a lot of earth-moving equipment, a substantial amount of equipment for the number of homes that are really going out there. So they've been approved to do a few twin homes on one side of the Country Club and then some larger homes on the south side of the Country Club. And that's been in the county's fringe plan and the city's fringe plan for a while that could happen. It's been about 2.5 years of process of going through that to finally get a plat approved this summer for it. But that is technically in this outside of the city because we can't serve it. We don't have water. We don't have sewer that can get there. So they have to do rural development to let that happen.
Okay. Well, I was about to say that we've talked about these from the individual point of view, but what is the vision for the development of Ames? I mean, we've talked about changing the plan, especially on the south side. What does the future land use plan suggest that where we should be developing? Are we doing it that way? And I thought there was going to be a revision of the LUPP, and we haven't had that. So
the vision is pretty much the same in terms of where growth is going to happen, and that's mostly because we didn't exactly do what we said we were going to do 20 years ago. So these large areas in the southwest, south of Highway 30, and then the northwest, which is north of the railroad tracks actually, those are areas that were highlighted as future areas for growth in the city. We didn't really build there. Lack of available land. We did more infill than was predicted in the older plan. And then north growth wasn't in the original plan, and that was a product of availability that came out about 10 years ago. So we kind of did things a little bit differently. But we are going to do a new land use plan. So the idea of what's the vision of Ames, that has to come out of this next comprehensive plan. There's some good policies and goals from 1997, but they don't really translate to today. So we, at a minimum, we need to relook at how those are worded. What does that mean in current thinking of what sustainability is? What's environmental design? What's our housing need? What are we really looking for translating those ideas from 1997 to 2017 to 2040 is probably what we'll be looking at as our horizon for another 20 years of development in Ames.
And when is this going to be discussed?
The way it's planned right now is our department gets a work plan from council for these policy or study issues that we get. The last work plan has us committed to initiating that process at the end of next year. So we'll have to start in the middle of next year getting the city council kind of background information about how they want to go about doing this. What's the public participation ideas? What's the format of the plan? Then we'll have to put a proposal together to seek a consultant to help us kind of pull this all together. It's probably over a two-year process. The last city council didn't want to just do a piecemeal update, which is what we first talked about when I got here, was, well, we just need to fix a few things and we'll be fine. I think everybody kind of realized that really was just a Band-Aid, and they decided we didn't want to do that. We wanted to rethink Ames' future, and that's where we got this commitment that in 2017 we'd start a full comprehensive citywide look at the plan.
Okay. You have some experience as a planner in other places. Mm-hmm. Carlton, what's your perspective of Ames' vision?
It's overdue.
Okay.
I think we'd all probably be in agreement there. I hope that this process will be inclusive and bring out some perspectives that reflect how the city has changed since the first plan was written in the mid-90s, because a lot has happened, obviously, with the enrollment at the university. Changes in expectations and behaviors of individuals, the millennials, and who are now becoming a big, important political and economic group in the city of Ames, and what they sort of see the future as being. So, I mean, I think that this is an important step, and I hope it will bring the city a little bit more of a kind of collective vision than it seems to currently have, and not only just speak to those of us who work in this or around this business, but those who are not connected to it, but who are interested in the fate of the city as well, to get everybody kind of on the same page about what the city should look like, how it should function, how people should get around, where development should be, the kind of development that people want in the future. Because this is, I mean, as Kelly noted, this is a very long horizon. So when you talk about these issues over a 20-year period or 25-year period, you're really sort of projecting out a lot of stuff that doesn't yet exist, but you're setting, a framework for how it should come to exist. And so I'm hoping that this will be a big step in the planning culture and the sort of community development culture of the city. We'll see. I mean, it remains, obviously, until the process happens, you don't really know who's going to participate. You don't really know what the outcome is necessarily going to be. But it should be a forum for some new ideas, I hope. And we'll be inclusive. I mean, I think that's a big piece, is that the community has to be involved, and particularly the university community, because they're actually a majority of the city is the students.
Yeah, they've got to follow our rules.
They have to follow our rules, but
the university doesn't have to follow our plan. That's what makes it challenging. If they decide to build classroom space or student dorms, the city doesn't review those. That's a state function that's outside of us. We deal with the private developers that are trying to capture the market that's created by ISU, but we don't really regulate or permit ISU facilities at all. The one thing I just wanted to add, so next year we're going to start the full plan. We did start the corridor plan for Lincoln Way in January, and then in November and December we're going to be coming back with some focus area recommendations. So the whole corridor was to be evaluated, but we knew we can't plan every inch of a six-mile corridor. So there's five areas that we call focus areas, which we'll be putting out some ideas of kind of what do we really think infill can be or even should be maybe on certain areas of the corridor. So if people are interested in things around the Kellogg downtown area, if you're interested in the Oak Riverside neighborhood, there's two focus areas there. There's one just west of campus near Highland. And then you have the West Hy-Vee area. So those five areas are going to be up for some idea discussion in that corridor plan the next few months. So we really want to get that main corridor idea and that infill expectation kind of put in place with that plan. And then when we get to the land use plan, we can look at other areas besides just this main corridor and hopefully build from that vision of the corridor to help guide the rest of the decisions.
Yeah, the infill expectation so that the residents there can expect that, you know, that there should be greater density in some of these areas.
There could be. I'm not saying that necessarily every spot on the corridor has to densify, but because it is a vision, it'll be a long-term goal of the city, but there's places that are probably more prime for that and desirable than others, and we want this plan to set that expectation.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming in. Kelly Diekman, Director of Planning and Housing, and Carlton Vesmagian, Associate Professor in the Department of Community and Regional Planning at ISU, also on Planning and Zoning Commission. Interesting discussion. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Welcome back to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Were you aware that we have a Chinese Language Academy in Ames? It has existed here for many years, teaching Chinese children the Mandarin Chinese dialect. Recently, members of the school have begun organizing events that share Chinese culture with their non-Chinese neighbors. On October 30th, Sunday, they will be holding a Chinese gala for the public at the Ames Public Library. Two members of the academy stopped by for an interview with Ursula Rudenberg to describe the Chinese gala and invite you to attend. Jingtao Wang is a vice principal at the Chinese Language Academy as well as a teacher at Edwards Elementary School. And Ling Li is a teacher at the academy as well as adjunct assistant professor in the Department of Genetic Development and Cell Biology at Iowa State University. Let's listen in.
Usually when people think of a gala, they think of a ball with elegant gowns. That's not what's happening here. This is a few hours in China.
Yes, you can have 2 hours in China. On October 30th.
This is happening in the library.
From 2 to 4 o'clock afternoon.
How are you going to know that you are in China?
First of all, everybody knows China, Great Wall. So we are going to build a Great Wall.
You're going to build a Great Wall in the library?
Yes.
What are you building it out of?
Sugar cube.
You're building the wall out of sugar cubes?
Yes. Very sweet wall.
Very sweet wall. Let's hope it doesn't rain. Does the wall actually look like the Great Wall of China?
You will see. If you come, you will know that. By the end of the day, we are going to take that picture, and we will go in to put it on the newspaper.
And the headline will say, yes. Great Wall of China built in Ames, Iowa.
Yes.
And you have to help build the wall by adding a sugar cube to it.
Yes, we have a teacher.
You'll have a teacher.
Each station is all the teacher and the parents. They will be volunteers.
So you have different stations with different Chinese activities.
Yes, we have 8 stations.
8 activities. Ling, what is another activity?
Chopsticks.
Chopsticks.
Yeah. It's always a challenge to use chopsticks. So the teacher will teach you how to use the chopsticks. Then the visitors can use the chopsticks to get candy from a basket.
A basket of candy, and you can try and get candy with the chopsticks.
Yeah. There are a certain amount of time.
And you have a teacher who teaches you how to use chopsticks. Jintao, what's another station of the Chinese gala?
Make the dumpling from the northeast of China.
They teach you how to make dumplings?
We will make the wrap and fill something in and make the dumpling. Actually, I found the people around here, they do love the dumpling.
Do you cook them there?
Actually, we are not. It's more like you put the dumpling to a round shape, one by one, and go to one direction. Because in my hometown, the dumpling is like individual person, and you have more dumpling, it's more like you have big team, you have more people around you. And when you put the dumpling down, round, because round is no start, no ending, it's forever.
When you make dumplings, you arrange them in a circle.
Yeah, put it in a circle, and it faces the same direction.
So they all face the same, all the dumplings are in a circle facing the same direction.
Yes, it's like everyone follows the same direction, so it's a great teamwork. So that is what we are doing.
So everybody's on the same team.
Yes, it's like we are a great team. We're like a family. We go to the same direction. We are peace.
So at KHOI, we build community through communication. Mm-hmm. At the Chinese Gala, you build community through dumplings.
Yes. You can see that.
Still, once all these dumplings are made, what happens to them?
Yeah, we cannot cook it. Mm-hmm. Actually, when we make dumpling, we wash our hands very carefully. However, in the library, you know, it's the public. So we want to keep you healthy. Yeah.
Got it. We're speaking about the Chinese Gala, which will occur on October 30th at the library. It's a Sunday afternoon at 2 to 4. And this is not a gala in the sense of a dress-up ball. This is a celebration of China. This whole event is for children and adults, right?
Yes.
This is a family event.
Yes.
Ling, what other station will there be at the Chinese Gala?
Paper cut is really traditional art in China.
Paper cut.
Very, very beautiful picture. So in that station, the teacher or the volunteer there, they will teach you maybe cut an animal like a panda, or maybe like a Chinese character, mm-hmm. animal, building, human, and maybe bird.
This is common in China, cutting, paper cutting?
Yes, actually, you fold the paper in many mm-hmm. layers and you cut them. When you open what you fold the paper, mm-hmm. it will show you what you did. Somehow it's like magic.
You fold the paper up, you cut certain ways.
Yes.
Then when you open it up, it's a picture or a
yes.
character.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Actually, they will have a little art gallery. They put them in the frame and you can see.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Ling, what else will there be at the gala?
We will teach American how to write Chinese words.
Chinese lettering. With what kind of utensil?
We will use just water. We have a special paper. It's clear, but then after you write on that piece of paper, then it will look black. It looks like you are writing in ink.
It's a special paper where you write on it with water and then the Chinese letter appears like ink.
Yes.
Wow, yeah. That's very beautiful. Magic. And there will be teachers teaching you how to write the letters.
Yeah. And she is the one manager this station.
You're the teacher there?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. That must be very popular.
Yes, it's fun.
It is fun, yeah. Are all these activities happening in one room or will this be in different rooms?
In one room. It's
in one room, in the auditorium.
Yeah. Pretend 2 hours, you are in China, you go to the northeast, you are doing the dumpling. You go to the north, you are building the Great Wall. You go to the south, you use the chopstick. And, you know, just like that.
Mm-hmm.
We pick the scenes for each area. What mm-hmm. is really popular and famous.
From that area.
Yeah.
It's a journey through Chinese culture.
Yes. So that's why it's like, okay, go travel.
Go travel. Travel around the country of China in 2 hours at the Ames Public Library. This whole event comes from the Chinese Language Academy.
Yes.
And both of you are at the Chinese Language Academy. Why is the Chinese Language Academy going through so much trouble to organize such a big event?
More and more people are really interested in our culture from Story County.
Do you find more and more interest from Americans
yes.
in the area in Chinese culture and Chinese language?
Yes. You know, people, when they heard about it, oh, we never know we have Chinese school here. So mm-hmm. when the people ask more and more questions, so I said, okay, maybe it's time for us to open the door, to open to public. So that's why our teacher and the school, we decided to go serve not only for our kids. We are going to open to everyone if you wanted to join.
And that is a gala event. Again, it's October 30th on Sunday. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. We started the show with my conversation with Jess Mazur of Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement about various topics related to factory farms, particularly hog confinements in Iowa. We then spoke with Kelly Diekman and Carlton Vasmagian about development and planning in the city of Ames. Thanks to Dan DeGeest for assembling background information for that segment. Finally, the story about the Chinese gala. We were listening to Jingtao Wang and Ling Li of the Chinese Language Academy. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. And you can like us on Facebook and get updates on all of our show postings in your news feed.
Thanks to webmaster Ron Carson for making that possible. Local Talk was engineered by Evan Taylor. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was a traditional Chinese folk song, Mo Li Hua, or Jasmine Flower. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed the show, please tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.
Funding for KHOI is made possible in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. In the heart of Ames, the Ames Main Street Farmers Market brings local food and fun. Located between the 300 and 400 blocks of Main Street, including Tom Evans Plaza, the Farmers Market provides fresh local fruits, veggies, meats, breads, handcrafted goods, live music, and family entertainment every Saturday.